Welcome to Ballistic Radio, Cincinnati's only gun talk show. Join us. We're going to explore the topic of firearms and your rights as a law-abiding citizen. Ballistic Radio, brought to you by Kyle's Gun Shop in Finneytown, your source for premium firearms and ammunition. Now here's your host, John Johnston, on 55KRZ, the talk station.
Good evening and welcome to Ballistic Radio, brought to you by Kyle's Gun Shop in Finneytown, your source for premium firearms and ammunition. Visit them online, kylesgunshop.com. I'm your host, John Johnston. Remember, you can always listen to past shows at ballisticradio.com and get the latest behind-the-scenes info at facebook.com/ballisticradio. Co-hosting with me this evening is Andy Ulrich. Andy, how's it going?
Pretty good.
So this is a neat magic trick we're doing right now. We're not actually here, which is...
We're teleporting in time.
Yeah, yeah. So it's actually Wednesday right now. We are recording this show just because I'm going to be traveling out to SHOT Show starting on Saturday, my Great American Road Trip. That should be...
You lucky dog.
I know. I'm not complaining. It's only 25 hours. So this show is going to be recorded. That means I'm not going to be asking for any callers. Next week, we will go back to normal, though. So, anyway, we've got an interesting guest tonight. Pat Rogers is one of the preeminent rifle instructors, and an interesting gentleman just because he's been doing this a very long time and has never been shy about adopting new techniques or new technology, which I find interesting personally, just because you see a lot of trainers, especially the ones that have been around for a while, that become very dogmatic about what they teach and aren't willing to accept new techniques and things like that. So we'll get him on the line in just a minute. In some other interesting news, I think I mentioned this last show, but I'll mention it again. We are auctioning off the Salient Mark 25 Tier 1 prototype, Cry Precision. It's going to be auctioning it at SHOT Show, and the proceeds are all going to go to charity. So without further ado, we will get Pat on the line. And we've got Pat Rogers joining us. Pat, how are you doing tonight?
I'm doing grand. How about yourself?
Not too bad. I appreciate you taking the time out of your, Wednesday afternoon to talk with us. I really do appreciate it. So
it's my absolute pleasure.
Well, no, thank you. So for the folks that are not familiar with your background, do you mind telling a little bit about yourself and how you got into all this? And then that'll probably take us right into the break.
Sure, not a problem. I was very fortunate in that I joined the Marine Corps a week after my 17th birthday, and this was in 1963, so we're going back a while. But it gave me direction, and it exposed me to training. I stayed in the Marine Corps for 3.5 years on active duty and then in the reserves for a lot longer than that. And during the course of my tenure in the Marine Corps, I spent a lot of time in training bullets.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that irked me about that was the Marine Corps does an exceptionally good job of teaching people how to qualify, but not a great job at teaching people how to fight with a gun. When I went to Vietnam, absolutely nothing the Marine Corps taught me about qualifying was transferable to fighting with the gun.
Right.
I wound up going to work for the New York City Police Department in 1973 to 1993. I had a great time. It was a lot of fun. But once again, their ability to teach gunfighting was minimal, marginal.
Right.
Part of it was because it was a large entity, 40,000 people, kind of hard to train. But every time I went to a class and I asked questions, whether in the military or in the police department, I received negative feedback from them. Generally speaking, they would say, this is the way we've always done it. Shut up and sit down. You don't know what you're talking about.
Right.
So that kind of pushed me over the edge. I went to work for an OGA at one point, and that gave me the opportunity to start to spread my wings. I learned a lot about what we were doing, how to do it. After Desert Storm, I went to work at Gunsight for 12 years. That opened my eyes a little bit more, and eventually I started EAG Tactical 22 years ago, And we've been rocking ever since.
Yeah, and it's actually, you guys got your own line of rifles, even that Bravo Company puts out, if I remember correctly.
That's correct.
So I'm curious, I guess the first place I want to go, we've got another minute or so left. See, this is interesting, too, since we're recording the show. I'm usually pretty good at keeping track of time. We got about 4 minutes left before we go to break here. Thank you, Eric. I appreciate that. So as far as, I guess, through your experience and all that, you're a pretty big proponent of the AR platform rifle. I'm curious if you've seen more acceptance of that rifle grow throughout your career. I know that when it was introduced in the 60s and 70s, that people generally talked down about it due to some of the reliability issues that it had, but also the cartridge, too. So what are your thoughts as far as watching that platform grow and whether or not, I assume you're pretty cool with it at this point since you've got your own version.
I am. I bought my first commercial AR in 1968, an SP-1, and I still have it. So I've been around the gun for a long time. I've had the opportunity to train with every iteration of the gun that's out there. And more importantly, I've got to see just about everything that's made out there coming through my classes. So I have a basis, in fact, what I think about and how I talk about the gun. I think that the AR, at this stage of its evolution, is the most reliable, most accurate, the most ergonomic service rifle the United States has ever fielded. Certainly, there was a lot of negativity towards the 5.56 cartridge. After all, as people would tell me, it's only a 22.
Right.
Having said that, the U.S. has been killing bad guys with that 22 for a long time. We have a tendency to believe that, when people are watching television, they are considering that to be training. So once you get on a big silver screen and Sylvester Stallone or one of those other bozos gets up there, he fires a shot from a gun. It hits the guy. It blows him out the window down into a swimming pool 15 stories below.
Right.
And everybody believes that that's valid. It's not. I believe that the AR had issues, no doubt about it, in the beginning. Those issues were worked out. And the gun has been the most prolific gun we have in this country today. 20% of all rifles sold in the United States are based on the AR family of weapons.
Okay. So, and you've got an interest. I'm not sure if you want to tell it on air or not, but I've heard that you tell an interesting story about an experience with an M14 fighting from a disabled tank. We got about a minute left. I'm going to tease that right now like I just did, and then when we come back from the break, I'll let you tell that one. As far as the AR and using it, do you think that there's a solid place for a civilian to be using that rifle in a home defense role or even a self-defense role out in public? I know a lot of people say, well, what do you need that for? And I'd like to get your opinion on that. Just a 20-second blurb, and then we'll get into it a little bit more.
Yeah. I absolutely believe there is a place for an AR in defensive use. We like to say, that is, some people like to say that the pistol is the proper weapon to use in the home, but pistol shooting in the United States has deteriorated drastically over the past 13 years. The AR is simpler to shoot. It is a much more reliable gun than a lot of the pistols. It fires a cartridge that is more powerful than anything you can put in a pistol, a defensive pistol. And therefore, I believe that the AR is the answer to home defense. Certainly, I have one next to my bed.
Well, perfect. We'll talk about that a little bit more. When we get back, we're going to talk with Pat some more about the AR pattern rifle and also his thoughts on training. Right now, you're listening to Ballistic Radio. Welcome back to Ballistic Radio, brought to you by Kyle's Gun Shop in Finneytown. Visit them online, kylesgunshop.com. Right now we are talking with Mr. Pat Rogers about the AR pattern rifle and also going to get into some training philosophies here in a second. Now, Pat, you were saying before the break that you think there's a real solid place in the the toolbox, for lack of a better term, for the AR rifle, especially in civilian hands. I know a lot of people say, well, you know, what are you going to need a rifle for? You brought up some interesting points as far as about how pistol shooting in general has deteriorated over the last 13 years, and also the reliability factor and the effectiveness of the cartridge. Why do you think pistol shooting's gone downhill?
I think there's a lot of reasons for it, but certainly when we start looking how political pendulum is swinging, people are not held to a standard anymore. If they can't meet the standard is lowered. Consequently, we have had people, civilians, cops, and military guys that could reliably hit dirt at 10 yards, but not get solid hits. Yeah, I know. It's pitiful. But not get solid hits on the target. We certainly push for 25 yards at the minimum. We believe that you should be able to hit a distance, and while people will talk all the time about average gunfights, if you get into a gunfight, you've pretty much busted the average.
Right.
So when people talk about the average gunfight being 7 yards, well, that's nice. But a great many of those gunfights take place at a yard, and a lot of them take place at much more than that. If I can be accurate at 25 yards, I can be accurate at 1 yard.
Okay. And that brings to mind another thing. You mentioned the terminal effectiveness of the cartridge compared to a pistol cartridge. Now, even with rifles and shoulder-fired weapons, people don't always do what you expect them to do when you shoot them, right?
That's correct. How a person reacts to being shot is unique to that individual. He has a vote in what happens to him. He has a vote to determine whether he stays in a fight or not.
Okay. And you've actually, because I know a lot of people, my father's actually one of them. He was a veteran of that war as well. He's a big fan of the 30 caliber rifles. You've had even problems with those as far as stopping people, correct?
Yeah, that's correct. On 21 May 1966, we were involved in a fight with the bad guys southwest of Da Nang. And I was a tank crewman at that time. And hang on 1 second. We stopped the tank as we entered the field. We broke a 90-millimeter canister round into the chamber, which meant that we couldn't operate the 90 at all. The 30-caliber round, the 30-caliber machine gun, the coax gun, stopped working because it was overheated, and I expanded all the ammunition we had in the 50-caliber gun. I did have an M14 on top of the gun. I did have an M14 on top of the tank.
Right.
I got on top of the tank and was greeted by the sight of a North Vietnamese squad moving towards us. Actually, they were trying to get past us. The first guy in the line had a K-50 submachine gun. He fired at me, and I fired at him. And I hit him solidly twice in the chest at about 5 yards. He went down, and I shot the second guy in the chest. He went down as well. But the first guy got up, and he brought the gun up again. I shot him twice more. The third guy in line came by, and I shot him in the head and killed him. And the first guy got up again, and I put two more rounds into him. That was all the ammunition I had in the rifle, and I wound up throwing a fragmentation grenade on him. So
the grenade did it.
What, yeah, pretty much. He might have been dying and just didn't know it, but the fact was he wasn't incapacitated. And I think people sometimes forget that death does not come instantly to somebody who receives projectiles. Even if their heart was torn out of their body, they could probably still live for another 10 or 15 seconds.
Right.
So there is nothing, as far as I'm concerned, nothing that you can hold in one or two hands that is going to guarantee that you will put somebody down with a single or even multiple rounds.
All right. So I guess at that point, accurate hits become extremely important, and also having a larger reserve of ammunition in case the first few shots don't work?
Yeah, and therein lies another fallacy of the left. They talk a lot about how it should only require a single shot to put somebody down. In my experience, that rarely happens. and I would rather have more ammunition in the gun than less ammunition in the gun. Certainly, we would like to think that we would never face more than one opponent at a time, but that's not always the case. I travel in a car across country a lot. I stop to get gas in gas stations, and it's not unusual for a carload of shady characters to pull up next to me to check me out.
Right.
And I often wonder what it'd be like having to engage four people simultaneously when carrying an eight-shot pistol.
Right. Okay. So if you're able, and obviously I'm kind of steering the questions here to get the answers that I want. I'm a big fan of the AR platform rifle. I'm a big fan of having a rifle available to you for self-defense purposes. It's, you know, all rhetoric aside on my part and the proponents of the system, it's really a good weapon platform to have. If I know that you make your own version of the AR. What's a good AR setup look like? What are the things that it needs to have? Is there a difference between the different? I mean, everyone and their cousin makes ARs right now. So, is there a difference between all of them, or what have you seen?
There absolutely is a difference, and we have seen this shift for the better over the years. A long time ago, there were very few AR manufacturers, and because of that, you could put out about anything, any type of product, and people would buy it because you own the market. Right now, there's a large number of people making the AR platform. Some of them do a pretty good job, and some of them do a job that is a little bit less than stellar. From my experience, the guns that are done correctly are the guns that are built to a specification. The term mil-spec is grossly overused, and certainly very few civilian guns could be called mil-spec as they are not capable of full automatic or burst fire, and barrel length becomes an issue. However, companies that do build military guns, as a rule, build exceptionally good commercial guns. And there's a number of commercial dealers out there. And clearly, this is a shameless plug for Bravo Company because they do build my rifles.
That's all right. I like their rifles.
Yeah, I do too. but they make their guns to a specification, and they don't skimp on anything. Consequently, they work. And we have seen this in class over the years. We are getting students now that are much better equipped, much more knowledgeable, and they're bringing better equipment, guns, magazines, ammunition, optics, etc., with them than we have seen in the past. So we're pretty happy about that.
Right. Now, in general, there's, I guess, I kind of think of it as a consumer-grade guns, and then there's work guns, fighting guns, whatever you want to call them. As you said, they're not necessarily mil-spec. A lot of times the standard's exceeded from the mil-spec standard, and things are just a little bit different. But you know, you mentioned Bravo Company. There's Daniel Defense. There's Colt. You know, I'm a big fan of Knight's Armament. The full disclosure, I've kind of got a nice relationship with them as well. But in general, if you stick to the better known manufacturers, your rifle's going to be okay.
As a rule, yes. You know, certainly nothing is perfect, and
right,
every once in a while you can get a lemon. However, how the company handles problems says a lot about what they do. My feeling about different grades of guns is this. We need to define our mission requirements. Once we do that, we have to look for the very best equipment the money can buy, and then we have to seek training. And after we do all that, we need to train some more. So the point I'm trying to make is this. Not everybody who buys an AR, as a matter of fact, I would probably say about 80% of the people who own ARs rarely shoot their guns. Mm-hmm. They may take them out and fire 20 rounds and then put it away, and maybe on alternate Thursdays in months ending with vowels, they'll come out and shoot another 20 or 30 rounds. And so for these people, you don't need a great gun.
Right.
You need a reasonable gun, and it'll probably do you pretty well. For people that do it for a living, guys at the cops, people that work in a business, private military contractors, et cetera. Certainly, we're shooting a lot more now than we ever did,
right.
ever. And we're putting a lot more rounds on the guns, so we have a pretty good idea of what guns work and what guns don't work. We see trends going on.
Yeah.
If you don't need a gun for everyday use, buy whatever you want. If you need something for realistic use, you need to spend your money wisely. And the difference between a hobby gun and a real gun, that is a true fighting gun, is relatively minor.
Right, but they're important differences. Hey, I'm going to interrupt you just real quick, Pat, because we have to go to break. But when we get back, we're going to talk with Pat Rogers a little bit more about the difference between hobby guns and fighting guns. Also, too, some training theories. Right now, you're listening to Ballistic Radio. Welcome back to Ballistic Radio, brought to you by Kyle's Gun Shop in Finneytown. Visit them online, kylesgunshop.com. Right now, we are talking with Pat Rogers about the AR pattern rifle for home defense and self-defense. Also going to get into some theories on training and accepting new technology. Now, Pat, when we were before the break, you were talking about the differences between the hobby guns and the fighting guns being relatively minor. But I assume those differences are extremely important. Do you mind kind of getting into that just a little bit, and then we'll move on to some other cool things?
Certainly. People like to say that parts is parts, and nothing can be further from the truth. There are different grades of parts in the gun world, just like there are in the aviation world. Starting off with good parts is certainly an answer, but it's not the only answer. We have to be able to assemble these parts correctly. And it takes talented people a long time to understand how we do make the gun correctly. To go back to parts, other things that wear on a gun, the majority of them occur in the upper receiver and are circled right around the bolt carry group. If, as a rule, on the mil-spec guns, they're magnetic particle inspected, they're shot pinned, but on the hobby guns, they're not. Consequently, we see bolts break on the hobby guns on a pretty regular basis, and they'll break right at the bolt cam pin hole. On guns made to spec, we'll see them crack at a certain round count, but they'll generally crack on the bolt lug, the locking lug, which does not adversely affect the operation of the gun. So having a bolt that is properly made is a big step. On a bolt carrier, the gas key, the portion that takes the gas tube and then drives that down into the bolt carrier and move the bolt, needs to be staked. And a lot of companies will not stake it. They'll use Loctite or torque it down to a certain specification of their own. And what we see on a lot of guns is that they'll stop working pretty early on because the gas key is not staked. You're spending less money for a gun, not because they want to make it easier for you, but rather because they want to show a higher profit margin for them. So anytime you see a bargain gun, there's a reason why it is a bargain. And that's generally because they are not taking the steps necessary to make a good gun.
Okay. And that, and once again, it, and you said this already, but I'll repeat it. If, you know, if I guess if what you're doing is shooting 20 rounds through it once or twice a year and you need it to get through one magazine maybe once in your life, that it becomes less of an issue. But if you're going to be shooting a lot and if you're actually going to be working with the gun, that's when you want to look for the higher quality option.
Absolutely.
Okay. So we'll switch gears here a little bit. You're an interesting fellow just because, and I'll say it as nicely as I can, but you've been around the industry for a very long time, but you're always very willing to adopt new technology and push forward new technology and also training techniques. I'm curious as to why that is, do you think? And have you noticed that there aren't as many people that do that?
Let me start off the first part of that.
Yes.
I was always very disappointed when I received my initial training in the Marine Corps that while they taught us the basics of marksmanship, they didn't teach us anything about gunfighting. And it wasn't until as a civilian working at for the Marine Corps on the West Coast that I actually got to see true gunfighting instruction in the Marine Corps. When people get into a rut, generally they will produce a significantly inferior product. The majority of instructors that are out there are not true instructors. Now, I'm not necessarily talking about the civilian side of the house, but an awful lot of military instructors, an awful lot of police instructors, and an awful lot of CCW instructors are not true instructors. Rather, they are readers of the POI. They know how to read the program of instruction. They know how to deliver it. But they aren't capable of answering questions, and they aren't capable of questioning the dogma.
Right.
I've seen that in places that I've worked, where some of the stuff was stuck in the 80s. You know, it was very good in 1980, but it's not good now. We evolve, and certainly this war has given us a lot more information on what works and what doesn't work. Our tactics, techniques, procedures. Technology have all helped us enormously.
Okay. So as far as why, I mean, so the people are good at reading the program or they find something that works and they stick with it. Why do you think they don't evolve then? I mean, just because it's easier to do what you've always been doing?
Absolutely. Plus, people who are in, as a good example, cops who are in a firearms training program, that's a pretty good gig for them, and they don't want to rock the boat.
Right.
Also, their exposure to what's going on may be pretty shallow. When you only get feedback from your immediate peer group, when you're not going out letting it hang out in front of everybody, you have a tendency to get locked into that one particular thing that you do to the exclusion of anything else, and it hurts. It really does.
Okay. So we'll kind of move forward a little bit there. As far as adopting new technology and implementing it, we'll talk rifles since that's what we've been talking. I had Freddie Blish on last week talking about red dot sights. What are your thoughts on red dots, and do you have one that you prefer?
Certainly do. Freddie is one of my really good friends. I've worked for Freddie in the Marine Corps, and we've worked together on other projects. So what Freddie told you is pretty much gospel.
Yeah.
My read on it is this. In order to hit somebody, in order to hit your target, you have to do two things. One, you have to put the sights on the target, and the second thing is you have to control the trigger to the rear as many times as necessary. Using iron sights, you are looking through a rear sight aperture at a front sight post. It needs to be centered on that. Then you have to place that on top of the bad guy, but the focus remains on the front sight.
Right.
Now, this works pretty good on when you're out on the range, cotton ball clouds are floating across an impossibly blue sky. There's rivers of chocolate and trees that give beer. But that's not when we get in gunfights. We get in gunfights in low light, no light, when it's cold, when it's hot, when you're hungry, when you're tired, when you're hurt. So while you can shoot very accurately with iron sights, you can do that on beautifully clear days. It doesn't translate well at night.
Right.
I used to shoot high-power rifle.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a high-master shooter and a distinguished rifleman. I fire that rifle with iron sights out to 1,000 yards, and I do a pretty good job of it. But the targets out there are inanimate. They're not trying to hurt me, and
right.
The only pressure is me performing. The red dot sight takes most of that nonsense out of the equation. All I need to do is see the bad guy, superimpose the dot on the portion of the body I want to hit, and then press the trigger as necessary.
Right.
We found it significantly easier to teach people red dot sight only. As a matter of fact, at EAG, we don't even teach iron sights on a rifle anymore. If somebody does show up with iron sights on the gun, we will accommodate them, of course. But the red dot just makes it so much easier.
Right.
Now, having said that, there are red dot sights, and there are red dot sights. Just like the weapons, some are very good, and some are less good. My personal favorite, the one that I use on most of my guns, is the Aimpoint T1. The size is right. The battery life is absolutely tremendous. It's rugged. We have, on a regular basis, we'll drop our gun on a demonstration, hold it upside down, and drop it on a surface to show people that, one, the sight will remain functional, and two, we're not going to lose a zero on it.
Right. So, and you mentioned something, and I kind of just want to key in on this for a second. You mentioned how much easier it is to use the red dot sight to make hits, especially in adverse conditions. I've actually heard, and I'll say instructors, but whatever they are, I've heard people complain, well, that's too easy. Do you think people are getting confused? I've heard
yeah.
it. I mean, do you think people are getting confused, though, about what we're trying to do?
Yeah, I do, truly. Part of that is that a lot of the instruction, basic instruction, whether in the military and police department, has a tendency to come from people who are competitive shooters. Hmm. Please don't think that I'm hammering competitive shooters. Competition shooting introduces a lot of people into what we do, and that of and by itself is terrific. But competitive shooters, regardless of the type of shooting they're doing, they have to worry only about marksmanship,
right.
That is, striking the target. That's the end of it. We have to worry about a lot more than that. We have to worry about our weapons manipulation. We have to worry about the tactics that are involved. We have to worry about a mindset, because we're not shooting pieces of paper. We're using a gun to defeat a human threat who's trying to hurt us.
Right.
So
I'm actually going to interrupt you real quick, Pat, because we have to go to commercial. But when we get back, we're going to finish that thought. Hold on to it. And we're also going to get into some of your upcoming projects. And I'd like to get your thoughts on concealed carry. Right now, you're listening to Ballistic Radio. Welcome back to Ballistic Radio, brought to you by Kyle's Gun Shop in Finneytown. Right now, we are talking with Mr. Pat Rogers about the AR pattern rifle, what actually happens in gunfights, or at least some of the things that we should be concerned about, and evolving our training and equipment to kind of learn from today's lessons and all that. So, Pat, when we went to break, you were discussing as far as the difference between in competition, and like you said, you're not talking badly about competition, but you were saying that the only thing that we have to do in competition is worry about marksmanship, whereas in a fight, we have all sorts of other things going on. Do you mind continuing along that line?
Absolutely. To take it a little bit further, because most of the training comes from the marksmanship training units, who are great guys, and they absolutely do a wonderful job, but they're not teaching gunfighting. So when it gets down to the trigger pullers stage, it's diluted. And you made a comment about it being too easy. I have had firearms instructors tell me that.
So it's not just me.
It's not fair.
Yeah, I was going to say, so it's not just me. You get to run into idiots too? Or
on a regular basis.
Okay.
On a regular basis. What really makes it interesting is when they tell me, and I had the chief firearms instructor of a fairly large sheriff's office in the South tell me that they didn't use optical sights on their patrol rifles because it was illegal.
Really?
So, yeah, and when I, as a rule, I don't want to belittle anybody in class, but this is just a little bit too hard to let go.
Right.
When I asked him under what statute this was, he was unable to answer for obvious reasons.
Yep.
But he kept on claiming that it was illegal. Now, I asked him to go back to the office and get the statute. Finally, he admitted that the lawyers, God help us, told the chief that optics were fragile and that if they were dropped or banged, the bullet may go someplace else and strike an innocent bystander.
Huh.
Well, newsflash, you know, about 20% of the shots fired by cops in shooting incidents actually hit their target. The other 80% go someplace else.
Right.
And you can certainly drop a rifle on iron sights and break them, and we've seen that quite a bit, too.
Yeah.
The whole issue here is, yeah, I want an unfair advantage. I want it to be easier, because if I can get the sights on the bad guy and put projectiles into him early on in the engagement, there's less likelihood of him hitting me or somebody else that doesn't need to get hit. So that just...
It irks me, too. Yeah. It's funny, because I was talking with our mutual friend Sean and about night vision, and this is a tangent, but he said something interesting to me, and then it sort of stuck with me, though. He's like, well, you know, nothing turns a gunfight into a shooting quicker than one guy having night vision and the other guy not. But
yep.
That concept of turning a gunfight into a shooting, I think, is something that a lot of people miss out on, and you know, easy's good as far as that goes.
Yes, I'd like to think so. You know, shooting a weapon is not normal. We're taking something that makes a lot of noise, recoils. It launches something that equates deadly physical force at the front. So there's a lot of issues that go on. A lot of people do not have the mindset or the ability to understand this. We used to ask people in class if they remembered the first time somebody punched them in the nose. And now we get classes of people where nobody's ever been in a fist fight. They've never been in a violent confrontation. This is a good and bad thing. I mean,
well,
it's nice to think that everybody is wonderful and full of serendipity, but there's a lot of bad guys out there.
Yeah, I wish I had lived in that world. I've had my nose rearranged so many times.
I have to.
I think I might annoy some people, though, Andy. Have you keyed in on that?
As far as, what do you mean, as far as?
Just in general, I'm an annoying person.
Oh, I don't get that from you.
Oh, that's very sweet of you, Andy. I appreciate
you
that.
You just offered to buy me lunch, and I turned you down.
Oh, that's true. Anyway, so going back to the topic of the show before we run out of time. So making things easier is always a good thing. I'm going to switch gears just a little bit because I want to make sure we have time to talk about it. Do you have any classes or projects upcoming, Pat, that you want to talk about? And then I got another question for you after that.
Sure, certainly. We normally teach about 40 classes a year. But this year we've decided that we need to slow down a little bit. So we're putting a limit at 24 classes. And while Our carbine classes are certainly our bread and butter classes. For the past 5 years, we've been trying to push hard onto the shoot house classes. We're very fortunate in that the Alliance Ohio Police Department hosts us at their facility, and they have a wonderful shoot house. And like a lot of police departments in the United States, they not only allow civilians to come in, but they encourage civilians to come in to their facilities and get training. So our shoot house classes are not necessarily classes that involve shooting. What they are judgmental classes. We're trying to teach people how to think. To that end, we use Lifelike Targets from a shameless plug here, but from ID Target Systems that are humanoid, and they react. Without having a reactive target, people are only shooting at a target.
Right.
When you have a reactive target, you have to take it down. And this adds a little bit of realism to what's going on. There's a tremendous amount of stress involved in the shoot house class. If you look at a typical square range class, everybody is online together. All the targets are online together.
Right.
The instructor will tell you what you have to do, when you have to do it, when you stop. And no matter what you do, the paper target is still going to be standing up there looking at you and laughing. Because of that, we get into a lot of absolutely atrocious habits, not following through being one of the biggest ones and my biggest pet peeve.
Yeah.
So for us, the shoot house, both live fire and using force on force, takes us a big step forward. The classes are long. you know, the 12-hour day and night classes over a period of 4 days. Not everybody is physically or emotionally up to it.
Yeah.
But everybody learns from it.
And that's, it's funny you mentioned that physically or emotionally up to it. I've been to a couple classes that were absolute just forests of suck that I managed to work my way through. And people always ask me, well, did you enjoy going to that class? Well, no, but I learned something, and that's why I went. So you mentioned Alliance, Ohio. You don't happen to know when your next class up there is, do you, off the top of your head? Probably.
And yes, as a matter of fact, strange that you should mention that, but we're doing a Shoot House class up there on 19 May it starts, so 19, 20, 21, 22.
Nice.
Then followed right behind that is the CQB operations class.
Perfect.
Which is force on force. And then right after that, where we have a continuing education course, which is only for experienced shooters. We'll use full teams on live targets off the range.
Oh, awesome. Well, hey, Pat, I appreciate you joining us this evening. We have come to the end of the show. Thanks so much for coming on today.
Thank you for having me on.
Hey, no problem. So next week we're going to be talking with Kyle DeFore from DeFore Performance Shooting about precision, especially under pressure. Should be a good show. And I'll also have a SHOT Show update for you. Make sure you check us out, ballisticradio.com. Like us on Facebook, facebook.com/ballisticradio. As always, be safe, everybody, and we'll see you on Sunday at 7 p.m.